Alright, welcome everyone tonight. We've got a couple of people here to talk about GovHack, which is an upcoming open data event. Leading Lottie is our speaker, Alicia.
Yeah, my slides are up, so that's okay.
Who's also involved with One Girl Australia and Engineers Without Borders. And also tonight is Jordan, who's with the ATO, but he's also been a GovHack advocate for a couple of years.
Yeah, look, my day job is, I'm a lawyer at the ATO, but I'm organising the Melbourne GovHack site.
By night.
And also, for the first time tonight, we're audio streaming on the internet, so just so you know.
Hello, cyberspace. Okay, so thanks for the introduction, Ben. So my name's Alicia. I'm a Code for Australia fellow based with the City of Melbourne. And my mandate over the course of 6 weeks is basically to engage with different departments and data owners within the city, ask them about particular challenges they might have, what data sets they have, and collate the whole lot together to bring to GovHack being held in July. So what I'm going to go through today is a bit of a background on Code for Australia, very brief background on GovHack because we have Jordan in the room, so he can do that. A bit of what I've explored with the City of Melbourne, what a notional idea, I guess, of what the challenge themes would be. I'm not allowed to actually tell you what the challenges are this far out in GovHack, and what the sort of data sets are that they'll be looking at. So for those not know, GovHack is an annual open data competition. It's held throughout Australia and New Zealand. There are prizes sponsored by different levels of government for different challenges, and honour and fame, of course, at the Red Carpet Awards. It's a 48-hour competition. This year from the 3rd to the 5th of July, so running from Friday afternoon through Sunday afternoon. And the goal is to show that our civic hacker community is strong, rapidly growing, and able to tackle tricky data problems in clever ways. The Code for Australia side of things, I think I put it in here, the unofficial slogan is basically getting geeks into government. So my role is to try and talk with people in government about how they can use smart people skills to do things more efficiently and better. We're an international network of civic technologists building open source tech. And this year, Code for Australia has enlisted 3 fellows to work with local councils. I'm based at City of Melbourne. There's one at the City of Greater Geelong and one at City of Ballarat. We've got a total of 5 weeks actually based in the cities, and that's coming to an end at the end of next week. I'm also based at City of Mel. The Open Data Platform was launched officially last week. It currently has 69 data sets available. If you want to go check it out, it's data.melbourne.vic.gov.au. The aim for GovHack is we're going to actually put a whole heap more of government data sets up on there for you all to play with. If you want to check it out now, you get a general idea of the interface and what sort of information is going to be available. There's also a real desire to connect data sets with neighbouring councils, which has been not so successful. But for instance, transport data, if you wanted to plan a journey and you only have the City of Melbourne data, it's not much fun to only be able to travel within the City of Melbourne and then find it stops. So connecting the city of Yarra, Moreland, Port Phillip, etc., to try and expand the whole breadth of that. Okay. The data sets. There's the URL.
I noticed that complains about needing a newer web browser if you're running on Linux OS.
Sorry?
I go there and I'm running on the most current Firefox, it still puts up a banner saying this site is best viewed using a newer web browser because I'm running on Linux, and it goes, oh no, you're not running on Windows, I'm confused.
That's good feedback, I'll put that through to Kieran. It's still
So it was soft launched and it's still yet to have its full media report. So if you do come across bugs and things like that, actually send a report through, because someone's there working on trying to fix exactly that sort of problem. There's a review of the data platform that's already gone up, comparing it to open data programs from Barcelona, Singapore, and New York. The article was called How Smart Cities Are Promoting API Usage. And whilst bringing up some shortcomings, which were perfectly valid, it actually was quite favourable. So apparently it's up there in the world class side of things as far as open data. Particular sets that you might have an interest in. BioBlitz was the first citizen science project to put up on open data. Helping Out Support Services is a digital version of a booklet that was sent out to all community services. It's particularly focused around keeping people experiencing homelessness, and particularly those sleeping rough and on the streets. Community Food is quite broad. It looks at different issues around where food for Melbourne comes from, where it's produced, different outlets where you can access food. You can actually identify what's called food deserts. So if you live in certain areas and you're over 10 minutes walk from somewhere that you can get fresh food, it's identified. So that also sort of feeds into the homelessness, welfare, community strengthening side of things. An urban forest is an identification of every tree within the city of Melbourne. It has its species, its estimated health, its estimated age, its canopy cover, and you can send each tree an email. It will actually respond. There is some poor person in the city of Melbourne who is responding to emails on behalf of trees. So please feel free to send that elm down in your local park and email, tell them good job, thanks for the O2, and see what it says back. It's not here. See, that's obvious. Now it's obvious that I use this presentation at Fort Works.
It's supposed to be there.
It's running at Fort Works, corner of Elizabeth Street and Collins Street. We're also talking about having a separate maker focus space. Initially at Docklands Library, discussions from today. Not sure if it'll be Docklands Library or one of the other library spaces. But keep your eyes open for updates through the meetup groups, Twitter, etc. Hashtag GovHack.
GovHackMelb is at GovHackMelb as well. But there's Geelong and Ballarat as well.
Yeah. And we're also talking about whether there's a separate stream or set of challenges, etc., to engage young hackers or high school students into this project as well. Jordan, you might be able to give a bit of an update on whether that's happening and what that might look like.
The short story is it's still at about that stage.
Okay, so this, that might be happening.
So, yeah.
Maybe, possibly. Or they're just lumped in with everyone else and good luck. Areas of focus, so the sort of themes that are going to be explored at the Melbourne GovHack, if anyone's interested in coming and playing with data for a weekend. Celebration of Aboriginal Melbourne. So there's a lot of data around both Aboriginal history and contemporary Aboriginality here in Melbourne. You might want to play with some of that. Intergenerational skill exchange. So looking at interactions between people on either end of the age spectrum. Passive smoking harm minimization. There was an article today published, I think it was in The Guardian, about the expansion of smoke-free zones within the city of Melbourne, looking to actually have an entire block from Swanston Street to Russell Street, and I think another area located as well. So there is a bit of a focus on the idea of smoke-free areas and create a smoke-free space. That challenge should be linked in with the Vic Department of Health Tobacco and Human Services Tobacco Unit. Climate change adaptation or resilience. I will elaborate that that's also connected with food security for this GovHack. So issues of where food comes from, where you can get food, think back to a data set I mentioned, and issues of climate change resilience, so extreme weather events here in the city, emergency processes within the city, etc. And laneways and placemaking, looking at some of the different informal spaces around Melbourne and perhaps how they can be used better through community engagement and community strengthening. So any questions on any of that so far?
So these are ideas that you're sort of throwing around that people may consider, you know, as some of the things you like to play with.
So the challenges that go to GovHack may be around this sort of stuff.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. Wink, nudge, this sort of stuff.
So just to give a bit of context to that, the competition itself is over a weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, right? It's international because we've got sites in New Zealand as well, but it's a national competition. There are national prizes, so there's prize money for put up by our national team, our national sponsors. There's also prize money put up at a state level, Victorian government, and we've got some other sponsors, not Victorian government, and at a local council level. So City of Melbourne, Geelong, and Ballarat City Councils are all putting up prizes as well. National team is totally paranoid about people turning up with code already done. They don't, the point is that it's a weekend hackathon. So they don't want to, they don't want to release information about what the actual challenges are, what the prizes will be, before the weekend. We respect that. At the same time, we're more interested in, and City of Melbourne, our sponsors, City of Melbourne, Victorian Government, are more interested in good results. And to a certain extent, we just trust people not to cheat. And it's kind of obvious if you've worked on something for a couple of weeks versus, you know. So there are a number of mitigating factors, but we're not going to be announcing the exact criteria specificity of the challenges before the Friday night when we announce with national team, but we want to be able to give people an idea of things that they could be thinking about. Data, so you can go explore the data, think about what's possible, think about, you know, maybe have a couple potential projects in the back of your head when you come along on the Friday night. So we're kind of trying to walk a line there, which is why we speak in these kinds of, this language. We are talking about this stuff.
Vagaries. So it's also that line of, if I just told you it's GovHack, there'll be government data there, you should come play with it.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Not so cool as being able to say, if there's a particular theme or issue that's up here that you might actually be quite passionate about, maybe that's something to look into. I'll also add to this that it might be prudent to have a bit of a look around support services around people sleeping rough and homelessness in the city. Quick plug for the other two, if anyone feels like heading out a bit more remote. GovHack Geelong is happening at the same time at the Deakin waterfront. These are the sort of data sets that they're looking to release, and there's this competition going on between Geelong and Ballarat at the moment as to who is going to bring the most data sets to GovHack, and they're going like this. I think Geelong is at releasing an extra 23 or so at this point, and Ballarat, no.
Scorecard on Wednesday night was Geelong's on 25. Ballarat's on 23.
So I was going to say, sorry, it's the other way around. Yeah, 25 to 23.
Are these data sets?
New data sets.
But what about the gigabytes behind them?
It's not the number of the data sets, it's the size of it.
It's the size of the count. Not going to go too deep into that, but I know one of the data sets is actually massive from one of the regional areas. It'd be hilarious. So if any of you feel like going and spending the weekend a bit more remotely, there's obviously a very different set of challenges because of the nature of the city and the sort of data sets that they've managed to attain. These are the sort of folks they're looking at. Geelong, city growth as a regional hub, services the city provides, business, I think that's pretty much around startups and trying and incentivizing business to actually come out to Geelong. What's happening in Geelong and rebranding, okay, so that's their branding stuff. Health in general and digital inclusion. Ballarat, it's at Ballarat Tech Park. Rosie or Rosetta is going to be the fellow out there. These are the sort of data sets they've come up with. Tactile ground surface indicators, which is cool. The CCTV camera locations, shared pathways, park counts. Planning applications, which I'll be interested to see how they might release those without actual personalized data. Food outlets and activity around town. The old corner shops, which if anyone's been to Ballarat, the city, the way the city's set up has those ye olde corner shops around the place. Most of them have been repurposed to residential, personal residences now, but they're heritage and they're sort of maintained for the feel of the town. Their events calendar and the location of car parks and parking spaces throughout the city. Things they'll probably be focusing on, Ballarat strategy and planning, mobility and accessibility, it's the tactile pathways, Ballarat's historic urban landscape, and the waste management and education, particularly for a growing city. And just a replug of GovHack Melbourne, the 5th at ThoughtWorks. Hooray! And bring sparklers.
So that's the same website for all three of those GovHack events.
Yeah.
Yep. So that that'll take you to the national website. They have site location stuff for each. Each site.
So it's all sort of also a bit siloed. There's a national and then each of the individual regions. Yeah.
Yes. So.
And pre-registration's open now, hasn't it?
Yep. Yep. So you can pre-register on the website. The Eventbrite actual registration is going to be going up probably this weekend, I think. So you can real register pretty soon as well. But if you pre-register on the website, you'll get an email when the events go up.
Where's ThoughtWorks?
Corner of Collins and Elizabeth.
Oh, right.
So someone will be there, same as here sort of thing, someone will be there at the door to let you in, go up to the 23rd floor.
Nice view.
Yeah, it's a great view.
Yeah, it's a cool office.
It's very cool. There will be lots of snacks.
I'm in.
Yeah.
So, I might talk a bit about GovHack generally.
Shall we give a you?
I'll stand off to the side and we do Q&A.
Yeah, we can.
Well, we'll be clap now.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I realised that possibly I should have gone first in hindsight, because I'm going to talk a bit about what GovHack is and where it comes from and what it's about, and a little bit about what it's like as an event. Has anyone been to GovHack last year or previously?
One.
Awesome.
I've been to HealthHack. I've been to HealthHack.
HealthHack.
So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Similar.
Yeah.
Has anyone, who's heard of it before tonight, this? Right, okay, so a few. It's been, as an aside, it's really interesting working with it. It's an incredibly powerful brand in government.
you wander around and talk to public servants, and they probably won't know what open source means. They won't know what a hackathon is, but they'll know what GovHack is. They'll have heard of GovHack. So when you walk up and you say, "Hi, my name's Jordan, I'm running GovHack Melbourne," you get this positive. It's like, "Oh, I don't know what that is, and I'm kind of scared of it, but I want to be involved." So it's good. Anyway, so the whole point, GovHack started back in 2009 out of a thing called the Government 2.0 Task Force. They ran the first GovHack is a kind of demonstration of, I don't know, proof of principle kind of thing. Gov 2.0 Task Force was all about getting government to actually, I don't know, use the internet, essentially. There are a whole bunch of kind of broader principles of, you know, public administration and engagement and community access and freedom of information and all sorts of elements of public administration get tied up into government 2.0 as an idea, but in general it's you know, being more accessible online, being open with your data, collaborating and communicating with the public. So GovHack kind of came out of that. And the whole point, it has a bunch of different points behind it, but from a government point of view, it's a tool to start a conversation about open data and about how you could do things differently. So roles like Alicia and the Code for Australia fellows wouldn't be happening if you don't have an event, a catalyst, a strong brand that you can go in and approach with. So it's a really powerful tool in that sense. And it starts this conversation about, okay, well, what is open data? What are the risks? Okay, what are the data sets that we as a council or as a state government are sitting on that we could push out for the event? And the hope is that, you know, you use the event as a catalyst, you push out the data, and then you kind of get the ball rolling and you rip off the Band-Aid and they're not so scared of it. I mean, the open trees map data is remarkable. I love that as an example. So there's a website, Open Trees Map, made by a guy called Steve Bennett, which pulls that council trees data and just maps it onto Melbourne, and you click on the tree and get some information about the tree and so on. Such an absurd kind of data set, right? Like, before someone told me that, it seems ridiculous that City of Melbourne has the age, the species, the location, the notes on structural integrity, all these data's about a couple hundred thousand trees in Melbourne. But I mean, obviously they're responsible for managing it, so of course they have that data. Really, it makes sense. It's someone's job to make sure that the trees are alive and managed and not falling on people. So there are a million kind of assets sitting buried in, 10 people in the City of Melbourne back office actually know that it exists. And it's super valuable. I mean, especially when you can mix it with other things. So GovHack's about having a stick to beat that stuff out with, essentially. So that's kind of the government side. The other side, the public engagement side, is kind of this. The idea is to, I mean, you guys are here because you're all pretty tech savvy. You understand what free software is. That's a pretty big plus in the, when you're considering the whole population, right? So to a certain extent, I'm preaching to the converted, but it gets people like you engaged with public problems, civics. How can you contribute to the community that you're a part of, right? Like, can you, build an app, build a visualization, just have a look, have a play at the data, and shoot an email to Melbourne City Council telling them that stupid and they should rearrange their, their bin runs and it'd be more efficient.
you know, participate in the community that you're a part of. So it has these two competing goals, or not competing, complementary goals of engaging the community and convincing government to work with the community. So it's about building those connections. As an organisation, as a thing, I was talking a bit about this before in response to Ben's question. There's national organising body. They have their sponsors. They set the big picture rules. But that's all they do. They just manage it, the national thing. They devolve everything else down to the site people. So us in Melbourne, Ballarat, Geelong. We then are working with nodes, which are smaller sites again, like the Docklands Library, trying to get the school stuff going as well. So there's kind of each federated kind of structure, right? Prizes at each level. Prizes will have specific criteria, use certain data sets or attack a certain problem to be eligible. We try to keep them as broad as possible. One of the things I tell, so I have a lot of conversations with state government and local government kind of sponsors, and one of the things I tell them is, if you know what you want, if you have a solution to your problem, this is not for you. You know, go pay a consultant. That's we're not here to build your app for you or fix your shitty app. We're here to solve a problem that you don't have a solution for, or to look at it in a way that you haven't thought of. So the challenges are broad in that sense, as Alicia was describing, right? Their prize money's not massive, but not insignificant. There's a couple thousand dollars per challenge. There's usually a first, second, third, or a couple, or you know, equal firsts. We try and retain a bit of flexibility to award, exactly what we're awarding based on, you know, the quality and the number of submissions and so on. A couple grand, you're not required to enter into just one prize category either. If your app does solve three different problems, you know, you're eligible for those three, and you might be eligible for national prizes based on the data you used or the technology you used or some other kind of element of your project. So there's a potential to earn a bit of money.
The impression from what you're saying, sort of like one of the targets will be as broad as, you know, improve Melbourne, and so almost no matter what you do will sort of fit that.
Could be. Yeah.
As long as you're not terrorizing people.
It could be. So you could have, we haven't finalized the phrasing, so I don't know. But and I wouldn't tell you if I did.
Yeah.
But so you could have one prize that is improve Melbourne. You could have a national prize that is use national gallery data set. You could have a prize. Yeah, exactly, right? You could have a prize for the best hack from a team that has women in it. You could be at, there are a bunch of different prizes and they're focused at different things. They're not cleanly delineated. So yeah, you could be eligible for a whole bunch. Right, that's prizes. Any questions about that? Is that? No, cool, okay. So the actual event is at ThoughtWorks. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We essentially, Friday night is a meet and greet and initial planning. So come along Friday night, we'll have some food, we'll have some drinks, we'll have a feed from the national team announcing the open of the event and the national prize structure and the national challenge structure. Yes?
The organising is done by people employed by the governments?
No.
Themselves? No.
It's entirely volunteers.
Okay.
We have funding from the government and support from government folk. There are a few people on the national team who it's kind of part of their job, as in they have, you know, and they work on it during, you know, they have a couple hours a day that they work on it,
right.
And so on, but no, we're basically volunteer run.
Okay.
Volunteer.
The organisers have figured out how much the entire thing will cost, including prize money, and
yes.
All of that money comes from the governments themselves?
Yes, yep. There's a big long list of sponsors on the national website. Most of them are government agencies. Our biggest sponsors aren't. So national team we'll have an announcement of the national team and the prize structure for their competition. We'll have a chat about our prize structure in Melbourne, and we'll touch on the Ballarat and Geelong prizes as well, because you know, where we are one state where you can compete in their prizes as well. And then we'll kind of let you go at it. The idea is you're welcome to turn up with a preformed team, with a preformed plan. Some of the best groups last year do that. Also, some of the best groups didn't. So one of the things we focus on Friday night is getting people to talk about team formation. We'll give you something along the... What we did last year, which we'll probably do something like that this year, is you get a sticker based on what your skill set is. Right? You design a programmer, front-end, back-end, whatever you can do. You might have a bunch of stickers. And go around and find people with skill sets that, you know, or interests that fit in with what you want to do. And Friday night is about working out what you want to work on, finding some people to work on it with. The best teams have kind of a multidisciplinary approach, right? Like the people who are good at the software, the technical stuff, aren't always the best at the policy stuff, right? You might have people who have a good insight into actually what the answers should look like, who are useless at actually building that answer, and vice versa. So Friday night, team formation. Have a few drinks, sit around, talk about projects. We'll boot you out 11-ish, a bit after maybe, depending on how things are going. Come back in the morning and go. Build stuff. We'll be providing, in the venue, we'll be providing childcare over the weekend if you have little ones caring responsibilities that you can't get away from, or that, you know, stuff happens at last minute and so on. Bear that in mind. Also, we have on the GovHack Melbourne website, like govhack.org Melbourne site, we have a questionnaire we'd love you to fill out if childcare is a thing that you might be interested in, or that you know someone who would be interested in, might be able to come because of that. We'd love to hear from you, because we're trying to sort out the numbers and stuff, exactly what we'll need. So basically we're there to support you. You build cool stuff, we make sure you've got, got caffeine, food, that kind of thing. And that's it. So Saturday afternoon we'll get everyone to cry everyone away from their computers, down tools, and come and have a chat. A few minutes about what everyone's working on, what they need, what they're doing, if there's specific skill sets that they're after that they don't have on their team, or they're having trouble with a thing or a language or a program or an API or whatever, put your hand up. Part of what we're aiming for is bringing everyone together. We don't want individual teams in little rooms. We want to be able to work together, or help each other out over the course of the weekend. That Saturday, we'll probably boot you out. I don't know, depending, maybe midnight, 11, something like that. Come back in the morning. Sunday, you'll have to submit your project by Sunday afternoon. I think it's 4:30 or so. Your submission is an explanation of your project, short on paper, I think. A video of, usually it's just like
camera, this is my project. It doesn't have to be like fantastically, you're not marked on your videography, it's explaining the project. And the actual thing, right? The code, the whatever you built. That needs to be submitted, yeah, by, there's a hard cutoff, bandwidth, upload your videos early. But yeah, and then you're done. 4:30, done. Then we'll celebrate, and probably everyone's exhausted, so we'll celebrate briefly. We'll have a few local prizes. We have a Spirit of GovHack Award. We have a bunch of kind of little giveaways and prizes and stuff for behaviours that we encourage. So helping other people out, or you know, being a good team player or a good community member over the weekend, that kind of thing.
Best in show.
Exactly. And then we're done. Then the National Awards Night is 2 months later, sometime in August. We'll be having a State Awards Night probably a couple weeks before the national one. That's to be determined. But yeah, and so, you know, there'll probably be some bigwigs from Victorian government and federal government and city council at the various award nights. And Malcolm Turnbull was at the national awards nights, shaking people's hand and giving out awards and so on, which, you know, might be your thing, might not be. So yeah, so that's it.
And some data owners might be present during GovHack.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
So depending on the challenges, the people that actually own those data sets are making themselves available for some of the time to come and participate and be around and answer questions.
Particularly on the Friday night, we're going to be pushing for them. Oh, I'm going to be pushing for the most, but also over the weekend. Yeah. Yep.
Are we not talking about government-owned data? Which data
yes.
owners are we talking about?
Sorry, data owners, government.
Oh, okay. Right.
Not own in a proprietary sense, own in a responsible for sense.
Okay.
If that's what you know if that's what you were.
So for example, if it was if you were talking about you using roads data, then you'd have people from Vic Roads would
exactly.
be there because they'd be the caretakers.
I was just seeing whether I was foolish to assume that, but that turns out to be right.
Data custodians.
The custodians is a better word, yes.
Is registration open on the site?
No, pre-registration is open on govhat.org, so join the mailing list essentially. You'll get an update when registration does open, which will be in the next few days, I think.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Is there a registration fee?
No. No, registration is free. Please don't register if you're not going to come, or unregister or let me know if you register and your plans change. Last year, so we have a hard cap in the venue. I don't know what it actually is, around 100. We are not allowed more than 100 people in. We had, because we know this happens, last year we had about 180 registrations and about 60 people turn up. I'm exaggerating that a little. We had a bit more than 60, but yeah. But less than half. So, yeah, because it's free, right? And it's a couple months in advance. So, yeah, love your registration. By all means, register early, get in, because it will cap out as well. But, yeah, if your plans change, please let us know. Anything else?
What about people who would like to volunteer? Are you still looking for volunteers?
Yes.
Or?
Hit me up. Either best way. So there's a melbourne@govhack.org that goes to me on the website. I'm Mr. JWO, MRJWO on Twitter. Hit me up there. Yes. Put your hand up. I'd love to hear from you if you're interested in volunteering for any part of the weekend. I'll be putting out a call for volunteers closer to the event. Don't wait for that. Just let me know. Yeah.
Is there any sort of framework around what happens to these things after the weekend, like the program things? I mean, like the things that people produce. What happens to that stuff?
It's a good question. So the first element, if you have something to say, I'm going to answer first and then. So the first element of it is that as a condition of entry, it has to be open licensed. So we're not specific about what license, but if it's so your copyrightable material, your videos and stuff has to be Creative Commons by, that is specific. Code and stuff can be licensed under a number of open licenses. So there's that element. Then there's the much harder question of what do you do with it? Some governments, there are stories of projects that departments have picked up and wanted to and run with and employed the people who made them on a contractor kind of basis to continue to develop it. There are stories of departments who wanted to do that and the people who build it on the weekend have day jobs that they're not interested in leaving, so nothing happened. So it's a challenge in a lot of ways. So the Open Knowledge Melbourne meetup, which is, happens at ThoughtWorks Wednesday nights, partly started as a kind of looking for a space to try and answer that question, to have, we're a group of people, most of whom kind of know, a lot of whom know each other from GovHack, who kind of want to meet up and think about those kinds of problems and work on those kinds of things and still talk, maintain the government relationships as well. But it's a really hard problem in terms of, there are a lot of different kind of moving parts, and getting everyone keen on working together and able to work together is kind of a challenge.
There is the Open Knowledge Australia meetup on Wednesday. There's free booze, really cool people. But Code for Australia is also trying to work on this issue around having an incubator afterwards for those sort of ideas for people that want to actually invest some extra time and develop it further. City of Melbourne, I just had a meeting this afternoon. So I'm based in CityLab, which probably no one's heard of, but it's their innovation space for the City of Melbourne. It's ground floor of the Town Hall admin, and they are desperately trying to get an online presence because they don't have one, which is ridiculous given the style of space. Lorraine tearing her hair out this afternoon about that. And looking to really try and build actually a community around this idea of innovation in government, and having an online space that people can actually, blog or communicate back and forth, share ideas, use the open data platform, data, and then repost up and say, hey, this is what I've done with it. Other people can comment and go, that's really cool. Or you can ask questions and say, I've got this far, but now I'm stuck. And they want to invite people from the community into their physical space as well. So they're currently refitting out CityLab to have a bit more of the movable desks, Wi-Fi, etc. Actually make it an inclusive space. So the hope is that post-gov hacks, some of that might have moved forward a bit, and they might actually have the capacity to start engaging people more regularly and build a bit of community around it.
They've got a month.
Yeah.
And they're
on it.
They're really good. City of Melbourne's really good with that kind of stuff. I haven't spoken to them about this, but they would probably be interested with that stuff too. If there is a GovHack project that on their staff, to invite people in and work with them, talk to them, find out ways they can move it forward or do cool stuff with it.
To follow up a bit on Ben's question, I mean, from my experience with Health Hack, that is one of the things is that you have this intense weekend and you come up with something cool, but what do you do with it afterwards? And I guess that's an ongoing problem, and some of the things you guys have been talking about at least sound promising, but I can't remember whether it was required at Health Hack or just everybody did it, but we put all the code up on, I think, GitHub or something like that, which at least meant that it was there somewhere where people could get at it? Because I guess if something's open licensed but is sitting on somebody's inaccessible hard drive,
I don't know exactly how that was managed last year. I think there's a hackerspace on the website. So you'll be, if you come and compete, you'll be using the hackerspace for your project and stuff.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure everyone's project is still there.
Okay.
So, and that's national.
Okay.
So every project, every video, every documentation about the team and so on should all be up there on that hackerspace. I don't know what the mechanism was. It's possible that it needed to be on, like, you submitted via GitHub kind of thing. I'm not sure about that though. But yeah, no, you raise a good point, and that's I'll check that for this year. If we're not doing that, we should be.
Yeah, because we all have daytime jobs.
Yeah, sort of.
Can I ask another kind of completely different sort of question? So how does, so is the Open Knowledge Foundation involved in this at all?
Yes. So we are, so Open Knowledge, we run the Melbourne event, so Open Knowledge person.
Okay.
And we are significantly involved in the national event. I'm not sure it's fair to say that we are, like, we run the national event because there's a lot of people who aren't Open Knowledge or also. I don't know. We're very tightly affiliated to the national event, and yeah, we run Melbourne. So,
and where does Code for Australia fit in, Alicia?
Draw
a Venn diagram.
You'll live with it.
I was going to say, I'll say something and then John can correct me. So Code for Australia, as I understand it, has set up the fellowship program basically to help facilitate this getting challenges out and data sets out of government pre-gov hack and putting that together to then feed in through Jordan and Lachlan and Knowledge to actually make it hackable.
Okay.
Is that about right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly.
So Code for Australia gets money from somewhere?
So they got funding, I believe it was from the respective local councils.
I have no idea.
Okay, but I have
been under the impression they got funding from like Code for America, which they're something of or something. I could be entirely wrong. I'm actually
I believe it was at least partially investment from the different councils. So
So they're credible enough to get people to give them money.
Okay. Well, and they've played and like they've been able to place you guys in each of the local councils and you know.
Yeah, so they're given space, IT support, wage, etc.
So I don't want to underestimate how, like, Code for Australia, you three have been fantastic. Like, it is such an asset to have that kind of embedded full-time, able to have those conversations and push people and go and actually make it happen. You know, like, I'll talk to an organization and, like, I don't have the time to chase. So I'll have people who come to me and say, hey, we have these data sets. We really want to be involved. You know, we want to put up a prize and sponsor you and all the rest of it. And I'll great, love to. Here's what you need to do. You need to talk to your people and make that happen. Make the data, you know, get, you know, I'll give you the contacts for data.vic. You need to talk to them. You need to get the data up there and then we can, you know, talk. Just never happens. It dissolves because you don't have people like Alicia going around kind of prodding them and chasing them.
Yeah.
Well, and because I'm at the City of Melbourne, you know, I'm on Medyammer, I have a City of Melbourne email address.
Yeah.
I get introduced by, you know, someone high up goes, Alicia is here for these 5 weeks and she has a mandate to do blah.
Yeah.
Most people externally don't get that opportunity.
So your fellowship's ending soon?
End of next week.
And then you start, or?
Then I go back to my day job.
Okay.
With Engineers Without Borders.
Oh, yes. So I know it's not on the menu, but can you tell us a bit about Engineers Without Borders?
Sure. NGO based in North Melbourne, been around 12 years, work in Australia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia. basically gathering engineering expertise and going out and doing community-based work and community-led work. So we have long-term partnerships with different groups overseas. They might have water and sanitation issues, offering power.
Mm-hmm.
We work with universities to actually bring engineering curricula to different countries. I work particularly with schools and young people with a focus on girls and Aboriginal youth and trying to get them to science and tech.
Get more people in.
Hmm. All right, we might have to get you back.
So I would like to get everyone to join me thanking Jordan and Alicia. And now we're going to have Scott take us through a bit of the news this week.
I've used the website too.
Right.
The web browser on here really is too old.
Please note.
That's fine. Since last month I've been sort of collecting news items and just throwing it all into a text document and set myself up some RSS feeds that I'm sitting on my desktop. I've got these RSS feeds going and all these news items are flying. And I have an overabundance of information, and there's just, and then so I've got like lots and lots of articles, and then someone else comes along and sends me an email with an equal amount of news items. So there's lots of news.
Don't worry, we like lots of information. Should we give you a time warning?
Yeah, just give me a time. I'm just going to try and pick out a few that I found interesting. And then I will send this text document, I'll just cut and paste it into an email and I'll send that out on Free Software Melbourne mailing list, so it'll all be there for you. This first one was quite interesting, that big old Samsung is, let me just try and remember stuff. So basically the article was about saying that Samsung is starting to look at how they can be more open in the applications that they're using with their phones and that sort of thing. So that was kind of cool. Where's your down scroller here?
The down arrow should work. The page down there. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, right. VMware has announced two big open source projects. That's exciting for some people. Project Lightwave for identity and access management, and Project Photon, a lightweight Linux operating system optimized for cloud native applications. Midori is a new browser, has a new release. So that's an entire distribution that up until recently was not freely available, but is now freely available for businesses. Funding. Tor Project is receiving funding. Tor Project's getting funding from DARPA.
Wow.
Okay. So that's...
Why would they be doing that?
Don't know. That was an interesting one. One worth following up on.
Just say what it is.
if you don't know what Tor is, Tor is a means of anonymizing your internet usage. So it's a browser and sort of internet It's kind of a gateway kind of thing, or it's an application.
So it anonymizes not only the content of what's going back and forth, it anonymizes where you're going to.
Actually, it doesn't anonymize the content. You actually have to do that yourself expose yourself. It anonymizes the routes by which your traffic is distributed so that people can't track down the source of your traffic, provided you have actually bothered to also anonymize your content.
So it foils someone trying to, for instance, collect metadata of your...
Yes.
So yeah, that's right.
You should be using HTTPS or something like that through Tor, otherwise what's the point?
The endpoint server, so if you're looking at a website, the server that holds that website, they know who you are.
Yes.
But it makes it very difficult for anyone to see where you're going in terms of the servers you're accessing.
You maybe won't go too far into the technology. Do
you require HTTPS?
No,
not necessarily.
No.
It says TCP.
If you're just looking at the news,
it's just TCP.
No, for a hidden service, I believe that the address is a hash of the key it's used, so you know you're connected to that server, but does it encrypt the data as well, so there can't be decrypts along the way?
Anyway,
it does.
That answers Ben's question.
Yep. And to comment on the why would DARPA fund this, there's a long-standing left-hand, right-hand issue with the US government, where on the one hand, they want to promote things that help people in other countries get some resilience against their own governments or against governments the US doesn't like, and on the other hand, they want to make sure they can see all the things. I mean, we've just seen John Kerry and his second-in-command, John Kerry, saying we must have strong encryption everywhere for everyone all the time because we want to enable people to stand up against oppressive governments, and then his second-in-command going around saying we must have back doors and all the encryption all the time. And that was just within a day or two of each other.
Yeah. Oh.
Both as part of the same campaign for 2016 election. So they have very much directly conflicting agendas, and you can see that here in Australia too, obviously, where our intelligence forces want to convince the Abbott government and every government, Labor governments as well, that they absolutely must read all the things all the time.
Yeah.
At the same time as businesses saying you must encrypt it so that our banks aren't undermined. So
Malcolm Turnbull says encrypt your stuff anyway.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Onwards. So on that note, if you're interested in privacy and telecommunications, the Turing phone is currently being developed, which is aimed at private communications. So there's a link there to find out more about that. Citrix has become a corporate sponsor of OpenStack, the OpenStack Foundation. Black Box, I found on DistroWatch, there's a new Black Box release for pen testing and forensic analysis distribution. Bit of a stink over Valve trying to sell game modifications through Steam. People sort of got a bit upset, and so a new open source game launcher, like a whole bunch of people who were rather annoyed at Valve, decided to get together and create a new game launcher that's going to be open source.
That's a bit upset, understatement.
Yeah, they pulled it within 2 days.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I'm
so
that you should just pass them against everything, so they get up and rage at this.
Don't you touch my game.
Yeah, I just thought, okay, at least you're doing something. But
yeah,
okay.
So what's the problem with slowing game mods anyway?
Well, I don't know.
As far as I could tell, they were being, like, people were openly modifying the game, like, and I don't know whether they exactly licensed it or just didn't license their work, but they were just, as a community member, making mods for the game that were freely available to everyone, and then Steam started charging people to access that content.
Was it
the people who were charging for the content, it was Steam who was charging
I don't think we want to go into it right now, but it was a partnership between Steam and a couple of the game companies to enable people writing mods to start charging for them in such a way they could be licensed through the game companies, and so but then it all turned into a horrible mess because people were upset that it was undermining the community feel where people wanted to feel like they were a community where people were openly contributing, and once money started changing hands they felt that was undermining the whole thing, and so people started protesting by intentionally creating stupid mods that did nothing except charge you money, and so they would pollute the store with a whole lot of stuff that was a waste of everyone's time and money. And so once Valve realised that the community was against it, they pulled the feature because it was clearly not going to be used for the feature. And the game company they partnered with, I forget who it was who they started with, it was one of the big name game companies, it was like Bethesda or something like that, basically went, well, clearly we've approached the community the wrong way and we'll have to rethink this. So it's not that it was a bad idea to create a marketplace,
but
the way in which they did it did not go well with people who, the sense of community around creating things free and sharing them was being undermined by that, and that's what people were upset about.
Yeah. Cool.
Thank you. An interesting topic I saw regarding the Google Play Bookstore, people have been creating their own, creating an author name and then collecting pirate copies of books and selling them under that author name. And it's been sort of revealed that it's very easy to do and that Google are not sort of, don't seem to be terribly interested in the fact that people are using their bookstore to sell pirate copies of e-books and that sort of thing.
And Amazon, of course, has a reputation for the algorithmically generated books too, where they sell you pages off Wikipedia as a book, on demand. So you look up a topic on Amazon, and whatever topic you've looked up will match, and they will then, on the fly, pull the pages out of Wikipedia and make you a print-on-demand book and send it to you for whatever topic it was you just searched for.
Wow.
And charge you for it.
And charge you for it.
There's a bit of cheek out there.
So, of course, you could just go to Wikipedia itself. That would be the smart thing to do. But it's amazing how many people would prefer to pay for an Amazon print-on-demand book of something that seems to exactly match the obscure topic they've searched for.
Five
a book
box.
On endocrine disruptors in rats. I never would have imagined.
So Firefox has just released a new beta, 38.0.5. No security fixes, but a few updates. They're currently using the Firefox Hello function, which is for video calls to other WebRTC-powered browsers. And they're using proprietary third-party software, so users can save content for later viewing on other platforms. Link there, you can read more about the proprietary third-party software that they're using.
Which I believe only comes with the Windows version of Firefox, not the Linux version of Firefox.
The in-vehicle wireless charging technology adopted by Ford, Chrysler, Dodge, etc. has been released to the public domain without royalties or licenses. So you can read about that. Wireless charging technology, that's kind of interesting. This is probably old news for some. The US House of Representatives approved a bill on Wednesday, 2 weeks ago, that would end the spy agency's bulk collection of America's telephone data, setting up a potential showdown with the US Senate over the program, which expires on June 1st. The House voted 338-88 for the USA Freedom Act, which would end the bulk collection and instead give intelligence agencies access to telephone data and other records only when a court finds there is reasonable suspicion about a link to international terrorism.
And subsequent to that, a court actually found that the existing law was already not legal.
Yes.
But fortunately, we're implementing that in Australia now, so we
It's okay. We can do the spying for them. let's see, what else have we got? This was interesting. I saw this very recently. Yep. Australian law could criminalise the teaching of encryption. Well, this is not yet effectual, but it's kind of looking a bit dicey. The Defence and Strategic Goods List, which is the list that considers important to national defence and security of goods, casts a wide net over what is classified dual use and potentially even the act of mathematical division could be outlawed. And you're not allowed to teach it to anyone.
Certainly factoring large primes is very suspicious.
So I will end there. This document will be sent to the mailing list. There's all the links attached to everything if you're interested. There's like lots and lots and lots of stuff there. So, all right, yeah. That's it.
And now, finally, we invited Russell to talk to us a little bit. Given you're probably aware that Debian has recently released one of its stable releases called Jesse, which is a cause for celebration in the community because it takes a while to produce. There's a lot of work by a lot of volunteers, and it's kind of the culmination of the Debian project's work in a way over several years usually. So Russell's one of the folk in this room that do a lot of volunteering for Debian, and he's going to tell us a little bit about how he got into free software and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
Did you want to plug into anything?
No.
No, you're on.
So firstly, I'm sure you're all familiar with Tux. This is Penguin, who is about 20 years older than Tux.
You know, supervised proceedings.
I got here when I was about 2 years old. I don't do that this talk, actually. So firstly, I started programming on a computer called Tech1. It was a Z80-based computer that from the Toy Electronics magazine. So it's Electronics magazine. They worked their way up from various small electronics projects to building a computer. And in the days of the Z80, computers were much simpler. So, while you had one chip being the CPU, you had a separate RAM chip, not much way of memory controllers, and you had perhaps 8 chips inside a computer. And it was programmed in machine code, so you had to work out the instructions yourself and just type them in. And also, in subsequent issues of the magazine, they had programs published. The magazine published all the specs for the computer, so you could just design, you'd burn your own circuit board if you had the capability to do that, and buy the chips separately and sold them on, so you could buy a kit from it. So at that stage, the concept of actually owning the software wasn't something that I knew about, or probably most of the readers of the magazine knew about. Because, they published a magazine, and the magazine was copyright, and you can't sort of photocopy the magazine, give it away or anything, but the idea of having a program being a separate thing that's copyrightable wasn't something I even thought about. Next, I started programming on Microwave computers. Microwave is an Australian Z80-based computer, and the first ones had a tape drive for storing programs, and later ones had floppy drives and ran CPM. And again, there was a wide sharing community. People didn't know of free software the way we know of it now. When did the FSF get started?
1983.
So FSF was around then, and so the knowledge was out there about some of these concepts, but it hadn't sort of migrated to computer user groups in Melbourne that I was a member of. So the concepts sort of weren't really understood. At the time, there were various magazines and books published about programming, which had source code for basic programs. And so I typed some of those in and had to port them to the Microwave Basic from whatever Basic was written in. And the idea of a program copyright as being separate from the copyright of a book was something that I'd even thought about. For the Microwave, there were games you could purchase. You could purchase games on tape, the tape-based Microwaves, and then on floppy disk for the CPM ones. But again, I didn't think about this very much. I don't think the other people did really as well. So you had on one hand you had the tapes and discs you bought, on the other hand you had the programs you typed in from magazines and even from TV shows, and you didn't sort of think about these as being the same sort of thing as all being software. It's you didn't sort of think about this in detail. So fast forward to when I was at university, and there was an organization called APANA, which might still exist in some form, the Australian Public Access Network Association, which was aimed at providing non-profit internet access until they decided to claim ownership of the hardware that we'd all contributed and then become a corporate organization and make money from it after taking our stuff. But this sounds thrilling. So I decided I wanted to have a Unix server running to provide internet access for all my friends. And so I thought, how do I do this? This is in about early 92. And I noticed that in one of the computer labs at university, there was a old Unix box that had reasonable specs. So it was 4 megs of RAM, an 80 meg hard drive. By the end of the day, it was a reasonably powerful machine. running a proprietary Unix, I think it was a system V variant. So I approached some of the people, a lot of people in the US, and said, hey, you know, there's this box that's gathering dust, it hasn't been used for years, it's probably never used again. Why don't you just give it to me and I'll do some educational stuff with it? That seemed like a reasonable proposal to me. And their response was, we can sell it to you for $1,000, which was a lot of money then. And I had a PC that, well, enough parts to build a PC, which was probably valued at about $200. So it was a 120 meg ID hard drive, 386 motherboard with 4 gigs of RAM. So I started to, you know, build my own system running Linux. I played Linux a little bit before then, but I noticed that, you know, Linux wasn't nearly as capable in many ways as the Sun and HP systems that were using in the university labs. But, you know, it did the basic things. I thought, well, you know, I can afford that, but I can't afford this university offering, and definitely couldn't afford anything with proprietary being bought new. So the free is in beer aspect of this was a really major thing for me then. So, you know, I went forward that plan and installed Linux on the machine. Because Linux was fairly new, for some reason it only used 80 megs of 100 meg hard drive. I can't remember why it was, but there was some problem with Linux talking to the hardware and couldn't use it all. But, you know, that wasn't one of the biggest problems with Linux at the time. There were no problems with that. It was a pretty rough OS, but, you know, it did the job. People were logging onto the internet from that machine. I had about 4 phone lines and modems, so people would log into the internet at once. One of the problems with that machine was I didn't have a 16550 buffered UART, so whenever I needed a kernel compile machine, it stopped talking to the internet because it lost too many interrupts. It was, you know, early days, low in hardware, still had a lot of time with that. At the time, I wasn't really involved with Linux programming. I did submit a kernel patch to Linus at this stage for probing for all the possible IO port addresses for my Ethernet card, and he replied and told me that no, that patch was no good because if that was included, then that Ethernet driver would then crash some SCSI controllers, and so we had to not probe these addresses that were likely conflict. That was, you know, what ISA hardware was like at the time, so you couldn't probe for all the addresses that for the card might use because it might interfere with other hardware. So then, I was a Linux user, not a programmer for the next few years. In about 98, I started using KDE. One of the reasons for this was that I'd been using OS 2, and KDE at the time was most like OS 2. I liked the way that OS 2 worked in terms of the user interface. But there were some problems I had with KDE, like for example, the KML program had no way of knowing when it ran out of disk space, so it would just download mail and then not write it. The problem with the code in question was that the function that wrote email to disk was returning an unsigned integer, and you could have it was the index of message in the directory. So you have like indexes starting from 0 going up to 4 billion or so. And there was no code for, I couldn't write this. And so what we might do is like download 100 messages, and each of them says they were at position 0, and that was considered okay. And you try and read them back, and your mail's gone. I never actually fixed that bug. I was working on the KDE project for a while, but the project was of a scale that wasn't easy to manage for someone who wasn't working on full-time. And I think that the problems that I had with trying to do code to KDE were similar to some of the issues that are faced with the Android developers now, in terms of having a lot of work being done on the core of the project. And that means that if you want to work on the higher level stuff, you're calling these core functions, which are changing parameters, changing names and things, and you're trying to work out which version you're going to patch against. Google's solution to this problem, which isn't ideal but is one way of approaching it, is to only open the window for patches for a certain period of time. So do in-house development without talking to the rest of the world, and they say, oh, now we have a new release soon, here's some code, you can just give some patches and you might include them. And if not, then wait a year and then send these patches against the new version with the new function names and things. this isn't ideal, but it's one way of reducing work for them in terms of dealing with different versions. With KDE approach, when I was trying to contribute to KDE, everyone could get the latest code from the version control system, which usually didn't compile because there were certain people who didn't work on different parts of it, but someone would change some functions and they wouldn't change all the code that calls them, and the other code wouldn't compile. So it was very rare for me to actually get a full build of KDE compiling from the version control system. So then, after that, I wanted to go into a Debian developer. So when I first decided to go into Debian developer, that's when I was leaving Australia to work in the UK. And at the time, a requirement for becoming a DD was to have a phone number you could be phoned on. And I was living in hotels at the time, and so I said, okay, you can be phoned my hotel. And I said, no, that's not good enough. You've got to add a phone that's for you. I said, okay, well, a mobile phone then. No, it can't be a mobile phone either, so it's going to be a landline. And I couldn't do it, so that was an extra year and a half or so delay in becoming DD because until that criteria went away. One of the interesting things about Debian is that criteria for becoming a DD have been changing consistently over the years, and so at various times if you didn't like the way things had gone through, you could just wait a while and have a different procedure. So one thing that I'm sort of known for is working on NSA Security Enhanced Linux. One of the reasons I got involved with this is I was at a conference, Ottawa Linux Symposium, and an NSA guy gave a lecture about SETI Linux. And after someone later at one of the conference events, I was looking for interesting people to talk to. And you know, the people who were working for companies like IBM that have people talking to them, and this NSA guy was sitting on his own because people scared of the NSA, didn't want to talk to him. So it's like, okay, I could try to go through a crowd and talk to someone from IBM, or I can just go up to the NSA guy and say hello. And I did. And so, he told me plans were very similar, which sounded good in terms of what something needed. And so I said, okay, well, the same thing I work on. And so then I end up working on that for a lot of time over the last 14 years or so, which I wasn't happy to do at the time. Which, was that okay for me?
Volunteer work, or
Volunteer work and some paid work. So yeah. I worked for a while for Red Hat doing some Linux work, and I've done some small contracts for other companies that are related. Yep.
I believe. I don't know if you're still running it, but I believe for quite a number of years you had a machine connected to the internet, and you had a web page. Here is the root password for this machine. Try and see if you can compromise it.
Oh yes, I have a few funny anecdotes about that. The first time I did this was for a Linux conference in Germany. I think it was Linux Congress, and we had like a trade show stand for Debian. Mm-hmm. And I had the machine there, and what I do is I at the hash prompts type in rm-rf/, mm-hmm. and just invite people walking past to press enter. Yeah. And surprising how reluctant people were to do that. It's like, for me, it's like, if someone said to me, here's my machine, do an rm-rf, I'd be like, well, why not? I wouldn't mind isolating all your data. It's like, you tell me to do it, yeah, sure, I'll just do it. But people going, no, is this going to cause problems? Oh, no, it's my machine, I'm telling you, do it. And it's kind of amusing that people didn't get this. One of the other guys was on the stand asked what the root password was without explaining. So I told him what the root password was. And he didn't tell me he wanted to use the machine because it had a large hard drive, wanted to use it as a file store for some of his files. So I told him the password, because I told everyone the password, and he copied all his files there. And the first time someone typed rm-rf, deleted all his files. It's like, well, that's the purpose of it. It's designed to let you delete files from your own home directory, but if you told me you wanted to store some files, I could put somewhere else. So anyway, that night I created some Isilinux policy for having multiple roles. So you have like roles like a staff role, and an admin role, whatever. And so if you wanted to do something like this, like have a root account that has minimal privileges, you'd have another role for root accounts that can't be messed with by the one. And so that was a feature for a while until laptop changes made it impossible. Now, also another thing with the Play Machine, my most recent iteration was running a SLU's Play Machine as a Tor hidden service. Probably interesting for some people. but only a few people logged in, so it seemed that it wasn't as interesting as I'd hoped it would be. I thought that, you know, having a machine running NSA software accessible over Tor would be something sort of noteworthy, and people would, you know, go for that out of curiosity. And also,
is that still up?
No, it's not up right now. No one interested, so I just turned it off. But with the play machines, I mean, they're up and down all the time. So like, I run them for a while, and then when I announce that, you know, people walk in for a while, they get bored, so I just turn it off. And because you have to like periodically check on these things when you're running them, so I'm not going to check on if nothing happens. So, and yeah, I mean, as far as I know, also I'm not aware of anyone else running SSH as a Tor in service. I'm sure someone's done it before because it's a fairly obvious thing to do, but I'm not aware of anyone doing it. And when I did a Google search for instructions on how to set it up, I didn't find, you know, anything other than the basic information on how to set up Tor in services. So I mean, my blog post about running an SSH play machine as a hidden service is something that could be useful for anyone who wants to run SSH over Tor. And so I thought it might put some interest for that, if nothing else, but apparently not. With all these things, like, you know, you try writing code and see how it goes. Some things you're interested in, some things you don't. So basically, I thought, you know, I'll just play with it, see how it goes. And, you know, it worked well and became really popular. Other things, you know, people play on it and it doesn't. You like it, yeah. Now, another thing, over the years, I've observed firsthand that the transition to Linux as a business platform. So when I was first working in the mid-90s, there was like there was no one using Linux commercially for anything really. So the only in the 90s, the only commercial user of Linux that I recall personally using was when I was running Internet Cafe, and that's because I chose it. And I know there are other Internet Cafes running it, but none of them was employing me. Companies were employing me were all doing mostly Windows and a bit of OS 2. And then I was in the early 2000s, I was doing a lot of Solaris work, and so the ISPs were running Solaris. At one stage, I had my company I was working for, but it was I was talking to the manager about the possibility of running Linux because of obvious cost benefits. And he was trying to tell me that running Solaris was a benefit for the share price. Because he thought that, because the management company apparently thought that investors would, you know, want to invest money in a company that's using Solaris and not invest money in a company that's using Linux. I never really bought that because, you know, when you think about your investor shares, I mean, you don't think about, you know, what operating system they're using. You think about, you know, are they giving you return on investment? Do they look to be incompetent? Do they have lawsuits? You just assume that, you know, if the IT stuff's working, you're not going to notice it. You know, if you have news articles about, you know, the software crashing and having downtime, as the company actually in fact was having, then that would be a negative thing for the share price.
I think it might be a testament to the marketing power of Sun at the time when they had all those ads saying we're the .dot and the .com, and they were promoting heavily that, you know, Solaris stands behind all the major websites, blah blah blah, and so obviously that advertising had some effect on him, and he was like, well, cool, if this is what everyone's using, it'll look good to my investors.
Believing that Sun was a good platform for doing these things, I mean, that's understandable. And also, I mean, at the time, there were some actual good reasons for this. I mean, Sun was selling some fairly high-end gear that other companies weren't doing.
But from an investor relations point of view, the point is that they were spending a huge amount of money on marketing, and that some people believe that impacts investors.
Yeah, I guess.
It might.
Yeah. But so anyway, that company, a couple of years later, I was working for them, they changed over to Linux, so I worked somewhere else for about a year and came back, and the Linux transition already mostly happened. And so since about the mid-2000s, I haven't really seen Solaris in the field, apart from when it's, you know, the last few things that are sort of going away. So Linux has sort of taken over in that sense, which is nice. Although it means you have this, although often you don't get much, see much benefit as a result from this. If a company's going to run their machines badly and have the machines crash and stuff, they can make those machines crash and run them badly and run them on overly expensive hardware from name brand vendors who don't deliver what they're being paid for, etc. I mean, you know, these things aren't really sort of issues of proprietary software issues, it's just managing your purchases and you've got badly made platform, really. And yeah, so that's pretty much the end of where my story is so far in terms of free software and stuff. Now I'm spending a fair bit of time doing random consulting work for very small companies, doing IT work for a number of law firms, one of things, and so it's all Linux servers. And so nowadays, Linux servers are pretty well accepted. It's hard to find servers other than this. I actually did a couple of years ago try to get a quote on a Solaris managed server. One of my clients needs to have a big storage project. We're talking about many tens of terabytes, and for that sort of storage space, ZFS I believe is the only real option. The second choice would be NetApp, and I couldn't find a suitable data center that would do either of these without unreasonable prices. By unreasonable, I mean if they can't tell me and they say, "Well, I won't talk to you about pricing to your boss," that's a big red flag. Whereas, if you say, "I want to get a Linux server," it's like, okay, fine. Here's a price for four terabyte disks. Here's a price for 15 disks. These are all sort of line items. Whereas, so they could run Solaris and ZFS. That wasn't the line. It was we'll give you a huge bill, so big, I don't even talk about it. And it's sort of
almost a custom build.
What's that?
Almost a custom build.
Well, almost. Definitely custom build.
Yeah, custom build.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I actually kind of sense me. Solaris running ZFS offers some real benefits for users. And, I use ZFS on Linux for one of my clients, but there are some downsides to this. I'm probably too late to mention now, but there are some issues. I think there is, if someone could do it properly, then you could market a service at a data center of running Sun servers as a quantity. It's like, buy a Sun server, checkbox, how many disks do you want? You want 15 disks in the ZFS array? Then, who doesn't do that? That shouldn't be too much, really.
Yeah.
And managing things properly is hard. One of our weekend tasks this weekend is to rebuild a ZFS array with bigger disks. And that's an unpleasant thing that has to be done. And, if a hosting center could just do these things for you, that would be a real value add.
I think Russell may have heard this before, but I have a story about the dangers of using proprietary software and Sun specifically. I used to work for Internode in their head office in Adelaide, and they used to use Solaris and I think ZFS, but certainly Solaris for their very large file store systems that stored all the customers' email accounts and everything else, terabytes of data, all backed up onto tape. Well, one day it turns out that there was a bug in the RAID control firmware that would write bad data to the disk at one data center in Melbourne, and then replicate the bad data to the other data center in Sydney and write bad data to that disk as well. So it would screw your data at both diversely located data sites. This was very, very bad. We had a Sun representative fly out from the US and come and see us immediately because they were liable under their contract. And they also didn't want us to tell any of their other customers. And we learned something from that as well. We learned that we hadn't really thought about how long it would take to restore those tapes. We had to warn our customers that it would take 3 days for us to get around to people whose surname started with Z. Because that's how long it took to restore those tapes. So the problem was that there was bugs in their RAID control firmware, which of course was proprietary code, and we were using that rather than using the Linux RAID software or anything like that, because it was all Solaris set up. And of course you can have bugs in the Linux RAID software as well, but at least then there's a lot more chance people can see it, whereas with the proprietary RAID control firmware you're totally at the mercy of the vendor. At least they will send someone out from the US to come and fix it, but by that stage it's a bit late really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is someone to sue.
Yes. Well, as I said, they were liable under the contract, so the cost of cleaning it up and the cost of 3 days of pizza for our staff, doing everyone's restores and keeping the customers happy, all that was built to Sun.
Yeah.
Does anyone have a question for Russell?
Quick comment. You mentioned running SSH services over Tor before.
Yep.
I did read a little while ago somebody advising doing that for access to your servers as a defense in depth measure. A lot of people like to run SSH on an unusual port so you can't find it, maybe do some port knocking so you can't find it. Running over Tor gives you the additional advantage that if anyone's sniffing your network, they don't know where your admin's logging in from, so they can't go over your admin's home connection.
Mm.
So,
this makes some sense. There has been some publicised information about some of these intelligent agencies going after administrators. And so if you're believed to have like root access to an organization the size of Internode, then they would go after your home PC to try and get in there.
That's a real concern.
And I think is that if you're in this sort of position, then perhaps you should be considering other ways of hardening your own PC, like, you know, maybe using the same PC for playing games and logging in as root isn't a good idea. I was saying this is one example. It's, you know, a well-known thing that people do. It's like, you know, I've been lots of places where we have things like, you know, after hours multiplayer gaming on the corporate network that we use for you know, logging in as root to the servers. And you know, there are obvious risks involved in that sort of thing. I mean, games aren't really known for being securely written pieces of software. It's like, you know, the issues are looking good, not being secure. So if that's running the same privileges as your SSH client, then you've got some problems there. But that's I can stop for another talk about that.
I don't know how many of you remember the Kevin Tsutomu Shimomura.
We might give someone else a
thing. Sorry. That was a classic example of that kind of vulnerability, X-Windows vulnerability, where leave a window open and then we get in.
Yeah, I just had a question. What exactly is SE Linux? Because I've seen it like in kernels before. Like, I used to build my own kernels, but I never really understood what it was all
about. So NSA Security Enhanced Linux is a mandatory access control system for Linux. Mandatory access control means that the application can't choose access to its own data. So under regular use permissions, an application can create a file made mode 777 and therefore grant access to the rest of the system. And there are many programs which grant access inappropriately, and you want to not allow that. So SE Linux, you can say, okay, when a program running this particular domain creates a file of a certain type, and you restrict which types can be used for creating the file, and those types can't be accessed by certain other domains. And so you then create rules to determine all the access in the system. So you can make rules say, okay, any file this process creates can't be read by any unprivileged process. So one example is, if you have the program VIPW runs in a context such that when it creates a file, you create a file that isn't real readable. So if VIPW does the wrong thing, you can't write your password data to a file that's well readable.
Yep. So that means that everything that's possible to do on the system has to have some kind of SE Linux.
The design of SE Linux is just a denied by default.
Yeah.
So everything you allow has to be specifically allowed. But you can have fairly wide-ranging rules.
So is that integrated into Debian now?
Yes. Right. Well, on TechJesse, unfortunately.
Oh.
Systemd is a good thing, and I like it, but it changes lots of things, and the amount of changes I had to make to the policy to get systemd working properly meant that I didn't meet the JESSE cutoff time without too many bugs or too bad, and so this is policy default package was kicked out of JESSE. So if you want to install, if you want to use SE Linux on JESSE, then you have to use the policy from my repository. And I aim to try and get that into JESSE backports. So backported from unstable to the JESSE backports repository to use there.
Are you also aiming to get that into Debian 8.1 and the next update to JESSE?
I don't know if that's possible, but
if it's not working at all, what's the problem with updating it? So, like, even in Ubuntu, that would be fine. It can't break it any more than it already is.
Yeah, that sounds like quite logical. Yeah.
I always used to disable it in my kernel builds because I was scared of the NSA, so I just disabled everything that says NSA.
You can trust the NSA.
There are certain areas and things about the NSA I'm not going to comment on, but one thing I think we can all agree on, there's a wide range of opinions here, but I think we can all agree on the fact that NSA employees are very intelligent people. And doing something bad and signing a name to it is just a stupid thing to do. So if they were going to put hostile code in the Linux kernel, and they have the ability to do that if that was what they were instructed to do, they wouldn't assign their own name to it. What they would do is they would create a Gmail account under some fake name, send a bunch of patches that are actually good code, and you know they could write a lot of good patches they want to, and then send a patch that was good code but with one sneaky little bug that most people wouldn't notice, and that's what they could do. And then if someone notices it as being bad, they would think, oh, well, it's yet another bug in the kernel.
He's telling us we're not paranoid enough.
So I think it's pretty safe to assume that if the NSA was trying to backdoor Linux kernel, they wouldn't do it through AC Linux. They would do it through something entirely different.
How hard is it to write SEL policies?
Not very hard at all.
Oh, okay.
So there's a command called audit to allow, and audit to allow takes the audit log entries and makes allow rules. So basically, if you run a program and stop from doing something that should be doing, and you know this program isn't doing something inappropriate, you can just run audit to allow on the log entries, and it'll generate policy, and just load the policy, and it's allowed to do it. Now, this will sometimes require several runs. So like a program tries to open a file, you run audit to allow, allows open. Then it tries to read from that file. You go, okay, well, it wants to open and read. That's not really surprising. So you add that entry. And then you run the program again, and it runs a little bit further, and then tries to write to the file. And you say, okay, well, if this program needs to write to the file, it's appropriate too, so I'll allow that. And you can have, like, you know, four or five attempts easily to get running. Or, of course, you think about it a bit more and say, okay, this program needs to write to its log file. This is where its log file is. This is the type of log file, so I'll just allow all rules necessary, allow it to read, write, create the file, and then bring it to a high level. But if you just do it in the most naive manner, you would have a fairly easy process. So allow open, allow read, allow write.
Okay.
Maybe
time for
so
two more
questions.
So
it's a semi-automated process.
Yeah. Somebody hasn't asked one, feel free to.
Okay, so in conclusion then, I know that, firstly, can I have a show of hands? Who here has done a moderate amount of free software work that they've uploaded to various repositories, like put on a project like SourceForge, on Debian, all of that?
Yeah.
Okay, about perhaps a third of the people. So I guess there'll be some of you here who would like to contribute, but are perhaps wondering, what can I do, or is this really hard? Do I have to be, a genius programmer to do it? And the answer to this question is no. It's not necessarily very hard, and doesn't require being any sort of genius. This requires you to, be persistent. There are a lot of bugs which are actually fairly simple to solve. And firstly, contributing good bug reports is a good service that helps developers. By good bug reports, I mean you have to, actually think about what needs to be in the bug report to reproduce the problem. If we can't reproduce it, we can't fix it really. So you need to describe, what you did leading up to the bug, what the program did, what you expected it to do, and why you think it's a bug. And this might require some explanation, but sometimes there are things that, some people will say that this is working as designed, and people will say, well, no, it shouldn't be designed to do that, and we can be heard to wait about that. So you're producing a good bug report, and that's a service to the community. And for fixing bugs, some bugs are fairly simple to solve. So, for example, if it's a bug that a program writes the wrong file name, changing the file name to a file name is a fairly simple to do, fairly simple fix. Some program crashes are simple to fix too. The program can easily be made to crash. Then the debugger will show you where it crashed, and then sometimes it will be easy to backtrace that to where the bug is. Sometimes it will be incredibly hard, depending on the type of bug. Some of these things you just look into it and you decide whether it's easy enough to fix or not. And sometimes you might say, if you're starting out of this, you might find three different bugs you would have got, and find two of them, just you get lost in the code and say, okay, these ones are too hard for me. The third one might say, okay, I can see the bug here, and I can just think about it, and then try something at the patch to fix the bug. Your patches will often not be accepted initially, at least. Like, for example, the patch I described was sent to Linus, and he rejected it. There's a whole category of patches of things that you can write perfectly good code, which on its own works and works well and does what you designed it to, but due to things that you couldn't know about, it wasn't appropriate. So at the time that I submitted that patch to the network driver, I couldn't know that that was going to break the controller, so I didn't own that sort of hardware. I didn't have much background knowledge of the drivers, whereas Linus had presumably had similar code before and had to remove because people had reported that they were having been crashing, and he knew what the problem was, and he immediately responded and said, no, this code can't be accepted. And when you start with the Linux programming, or free software programming, you'll learn something a lot. You write code that on its own was good code, but it just didn't fit in the bigger picture. But you just have to keep trying, and this isn't a rejection of you, this is a factor that you didn't understand the big picture. so it didn't deter me that Linus didn't like my patch. In fact, I've never had a patch submitted to the Linux kernel under my name. The only kernel I've had submitted to the kernel would actually plagiarise from me and submitted by someone else, but that's another story.
Somebody from the NSA?
No. So, someone from a serial port driver company. And so then I stopped publishing patches for their drivers, so the drivers wouldn't be working that well. So that was their consequence of their choice. That's another story. And in the free software community, there is a lot of fun we'll have in writing patches, and you get respect from other members of the community if you've fixed things that people like. So you have random people come to you and say, hey, thanks for fixing that bug in that program, the program works better, thanks to your work. Or they'll come to you and say, hey, I noticed you've worked a lot of programs in Debian that I use, thanks for that. And it's nice that your work is appreciated by various random people. And so it's fun, and we keep doing it. That's it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I'm still working on that, getting Jesse working properly.
So that's it for tonight. If you'd like to join us, we're going to follow on to Classic Curry over on Elizabeth Street, and there'll be people walking over there. So feel free to come along. It's very casual. They do good value food. So yeah, thanks for joining us.
And if any of you are interested, Catherine's starting an open educational institution that you might want to...
Oh, tell us quickly, Catherine.
I used to be a lecturer here at RMIT for quite a number of years, and then I was a lecturer at Victoria University. And there were difficulties, and some of those difficulties were, I felt, a lack of respect for the students, certainly as much as the lecturers. The students, I felt, were being treated a little bit like sausages that were coming in, were quickly being turned over, cooked a bit, so they could go out into the world into a vocation, rather than the university being what it was originally meant to be, which is to expand thought.
Ooh.
And to help give greater insight to a society so that we can all move forward. And lecturers as well were being treated more like cogs. And it was all quite difficult because neither of those people, the students whose future this represented, nor the lecturers who were trying to create a future, were really being asked, What do you want to do? How can we make this place better? So I'm very keen on the whole concept of cooperatives. I've even been members of like credit cooperatives for my banking and such, because I feel it's much more useful when you've got people being able to talk. So I've got a new institute. We've got everything all up and running. Friends Institute. Someone asked me if that was because of the Quakers. No, it's because of My Little Pony. I'm sorry. Friendship is magic. But the thing is, it's about people forming groups of friends who study and research together, and as such are then able to create things very much like our open source research and development that we then put out into the world, and it makes the world a better place. That's the same what we're doing for this institute, and I've got Andrew teaching Ruby coming up next Saturday, not this Saturday, Saturday week.
And a few other. For
yeah, and if that goes well, Ruby on Rails. And we already have a few people who've signed up, which is great. But the point is, we want a cooperative university owned by the students and the lecturers, and then we can hire administration. The administration does not own the university and run the university. That's done by a combination of students and lecturers. And I've had people say, oh no, how can you trust the students? And I'm sitting there going, how can you not trust the students, for God's sake? If you're not talking to them, if you're not even teaching them how to be able to take control of these sorts of things, what are they going to be like when they get out of university? This is my future too, at least as far as retirement goes. I want a bunch of young people who come out able to make the world a good place. So I want them to learn how to do that. And part of our training would also be teaching students how to put together their own cooperatives. I mean, much of your milk products that you're eating and drinking come from a milk cooperative, and people don't realize how vibrant that whole field is. And we're already heading that way, again, a lot with the open source community as far as the style of interactions we've got.
And the Maker Labs thing as well. Catherine was involved with Footscray Maker Lab.
Yeah, Footscray Maker Lab. And I'm about to spend a little more time with Electron Workshop. So. Yeah. So we're planning. We're going to have Andrew's course first, and then we're going to. I'm going to have an open day in the sense that we can all get together and just chat about this and hang out and have coffee and find mentors for people who want classes, find lecturers who are looking for students, and find people who work well together to form. A core who can then we can then do the proper setup for the cooperative. At this stage, it's me, but we want it bigger, definitely. If it's just me, I will probably overwork and burn out. You don't want that.
Well, maybe we could post some information about when that meetup will be.
Absolutely.
On the Peace Offer Melbourne website.
Well,
we can have a look.
Well, you have a URL.
Friends-institute.org.
Friends-institute.org.
Yeah.
Would you mind emailing it to me?
Yeah.
There's a contact form.
And I also bought the domain name Sandboxland because I was hoping to maybe incorporate, my PhD is in storytelling for computer game design. I was hoping to incorporate a virtual world as a learning space. I bought Sandboxland as a way to do that. But it's taken so long to do that my variety show is sandboxland.org, which is this Saturday, and it's about superheroes, so hey, if you want to come along and see a show about superheroes, maybe eventually it'll become software again, but now it's a variety show.